Oh, good morning. Amazing to be in this zendo again. Got here last week and it was so wonderful to sit here again. And I realized what an incredibly important place this room has been for me in my ever longer life. So I wanted to say something about that. Different things that have occurred here that were and stories and reflections that may, who knows, connect up with some of your own experiences and practice. It was, I realized too in this trip, it was exactly 47 years ago that I moved to Rochester with my sister Martha. It was just this time of year when everything's so delicate and still so transparent, but the blossoms and the East Avenue was so gorgeous, and we used to walk here every day and work here. In fact, she and I on hands and knees, tongue sealed, these floors. It was after the fire, and we couldn't sit in here for a while. We had to bus out to somebody's, or truck out to somebody's home in the suburbs, and so this wasn't immediately available. There'd been the fire. I remember one of my first experiences in here, for me, was harrowing. It was suddenly there was an annual meeting, and everybody gathered. And it's funny because all these memories. I know where I was. I was right over there against the back in a wall. And suddenly it became clear that every one of us was expected to give our opinions, we're brand new, about whether the center should buy country land or not. I didn't have a clue, but much worse than that, I had terrible, we call it stage fright. It just speaking in public was for me high anxiety situation where I would truly just about black out. So it came around to me, heart thumping, and I'm next, and I'm sure I was red as a beet. I said something, muttered something about I like the country. And it kept going, thank God. And at the end of it, Rushy Keplow just sort of said, basically, yeah, it was all decided anyway. They're going to look for country land. But things change through practice so vividly. I mean, it's so obvious how much change can happen as we work and shed some of these layers. And for me, that self-consciousness probably brought me to this practice and was so intense and such a straitjacket. What a way to live. Anyway, 6 sesshins later, that first year jumped in from basically doing no zazen to 6 sesshins. And first I should say, my aspiration was very high. I was determined after reading the 3 pillars, like so many others, I was going to get enlightenment. That sounded good. And so I had decided, I'd made a plan. I was just turning 19. I'd made a plan for my life. 1 year to get enlightened. And then I was out of here. I didn't care for Rochester. I was out of here, and I was going to travel. And with my wonderful enlightenment, I was going to have a great time. That was my high aspiration. Kind of the poster girl for spiritual materialism. And I had not a clue. 3 treasures, come on. The bodhisattvic way, what's that about? So anyway, 6 sesshins later, actually in a year I was able to have a breakthrough. Sheer force of will. And, whatever. It was just happened. A small breakthrough looking back, but pivotal. And after that 6th one, we were going to start the first formal six sesshin. We're going to start the first formal training program here. And a good friend of mine, and not just mine, but I know others here, Chuck Myers, was going to go into that first training program. But first, he came by to say goodbye. He was taking a little trip to Grosse Pointe to see his family and then to come back and be here with us in that training program. Wonderful guy. Everybody loved Chuck. And I remember I was sitting right there when it was an informal Wednesday night sitting. Someone came in and got me out and informed me that Chuck had been killed, that his body had washed up on Lake, he'd been hitchhiking. His body had washed up in Lake Michigan, and he'd clearly been beaten and robbed. And we had our first memorial service here, at least first one I'd been at, 1971. And I was asked to speak at that. I'm not sure, I'm never quite sure why I was asked to speak, but anyway, I was asked to speak. Chuck was a dear friend, as he was to many. And I remember getting up, and that was the first time in my life I was so happy to be able to do this, to have this opportunity to talk about Chuck, and he was so present. This was an amazing event. And people had come. I mean, it was people all the way out to the back wall because he worked at a dairy, and all, we were all kind of hippies. And he worked at a dairy, and all these people from the dairy came in. And he was so present. He was so present. He was so right here, and I wasn't the only one who felt that by any means. And Roshi did the memorial service, and he did the flowers poem, you know, that we read in memorial services to the person who has died. And, oh, it was powerful. So it really changed for me just through the practice. But years went on. 4 kids later, almost 20 years later, I'm now monitoring in that seat right there. And I hadn't really been giving talks in the Zendo, been busy raising kids and now I'm monitoring. And Bodhin Roshi was the teacher, and he, remember in one of our meetings, he said, "So you want to give a talk?" "Okay, I give a talk." And before the afternoon Duksan, you know, the encouragement talks that you hear or give. And so I went into the Kanon room and I did my Zazen and I focused my mind, and up came something that felt worthwhile. So time comes to give the talk. I stand up. It's just before Duksan, of course. I give this talk. Of course, I don't have a clue what I'm saying. But I sat back down. This is all these years of practice. Don't lose heart. I sat back down, and this huge storm arose in me. I had not given the talk I'd intended to say. And suddenly, it was like tidal waves of this ancient self-doubt, self-loathing, even, you could say, of, oh my God, I just ruined everybody's sesshin. I'm sure that terrible talk, I just ruined people's sesshin. And I went into this, I thought this was all done. I thought it was all gone. We never know. We never know. And it just rose up like Mara. And all I could do was hold to the practice. Hold to it like Odysseus, you know, tied to the mast, going by the sirens. And in the meantime, well, at a certain point, this storm, and I saw it, I felt it, I faced it, and sat through it. And then the skies cleared, and I looked up. Where are all those people? Everybody, of course, was gone. And your job as a head monitor sitting there is to know when, how many people there are upstairs and how many are here, and you've got to know when to call the next group. I didn't have a clue. I just, oh my gosh, what happened? I didn't even remember people thundering by me. I was so involved in this struggle. And it was never the same again. That something broke. And ever since then, you know, you can give better talks and worser talks, but it doesn't matter. You just move on. It never came up again. It's just, you know, you say your piece and life flows on. But that was really something to see that was here, operating in the depths. We can never rest on our laurels, in a sense, you know. We just, as Dogen said, practice and enlightenment continue endlessly. And then a second experience, sitting over there, that really made such a difference. Couldn't have started doing the teaching, going to Poland and all that, Mexico, without that. And you never know. That sesshin, I wasn't going to Doksan. Bodhin Roshi was the teacher. I had finished my formal training and was just sitting. I'd been out for some years with the last child and hadn't gone to sesshin. It was very painful for me. I couldn't believe it, how painful it was physically. And I got this jerky thing. So I'm just telling you this because you may run into these things. We do sometimes. And every time someone coughs, and it was a Rohatsu, so there was a lot of coughing, my body started to do this. Oh, jeez. You know, what is this? And it was kind of embarrassing. I'm sitting next to people and I'm doing this after all these years, you know. And then I just had to go deeper. And the deeper I went, the more it happened. And then it didn't even take a cough or a sound. I was just doing this through that sesshin. And all I could do was surrender. All I could do was, you know, just dive in deeper. And things opened up. And the jerking continued right even past the sheen. But then it was gone and it's never come back. You just never know about these things. We don't. The body mind is endlessly mysterious and endlessly deep. And I have a little more time than I thought. So it's dangerous. You don't have notes. I tend to meander. So I want to be sure I don't go off in too many directions, although I really could. I was thinking here, you know, blood, sweat, and tears. This room, when a Zendo is new, it's like absorbing all the Zazen energy, all the Samadhi energy into the walls. But after a certain point, it starts to exude that back. And there's so much here. There's so much over all these years. And you think blood, sweat, and tears, quite literally, all of that, but also laughter. And I remember today, suddenly, one Rohatsu sesshin, and some of you may have been there, when I was sitting there, very good spatial memory for the Zendo, sitting right there, where Martha's sitting. And it was the last night of this 7-day Rohatsu. You know, you're getting up super early, going to bed super late, or if you go to bed at all. And it was just, the atmosphere was so thick, you could cut it with a sword if you'd had one. And everybody just, before the Doksan, I believe, and the silence. And suddenly, this is Rohatsu, remember, so December, suddenly a group of
carolers.
Mistaking the front of this building for an entranceway, it looked like an entranceway, we're all sitting there, and suddenly you hear, "'Tis the season to be jolly, fa-la-la-la-la, la-la-la-la." And it was, oh, we're working so hard to keep deep in the practice. But then it happened. The person sitting here was the first. Couldn't hold it in any longer. Started laughing, and it was just like dominoes. It bad, bum, 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 bum. And I remember it just like a huge wave through the zendo, and bum, 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 bum. And the person next to me, some of you know Mike Descend, who always forced himself into the full lotus and ground his teeth throughout the entire session, was grinding like never before to keep from falling prey to this wave, but he couldn't. And when he laughs, everybody laughs. It's this huge guffaw, and it was all over. And it was me, and the next person, and the monitors, everybody. It was this cathartic roar of laughter. Now, how it was for them out there, I'm sure they would have preferred hot chocolate and thanks, but they moved on. And then it was just magical. Everything just quieted down again. And we all returned. But it was such a release, you know? It was great. And we all returned, got back to the practice. Duck sound started. And there it was. But so many memories here in this zendo. And not only here, in this zendo. I want to tell you about an experience I had. On May 6th, 2004. It was our first sesshin at our place down in in the mountains of western North Carolina. We had worked for weeks to turn, and we only had weeks because we'd set a ridiculous deadline, to turn a two-car concrete slope floor garage into a zendo ourselves. And people have been working on it, you can imagine, really hard. And so we got sesshin started. And on the Wednesday, halfway through, we got a phone call that morning. And some of you may recognize that date, May 6, 2004. It was Scott, and he said, "I have Roshi here, Roshi Kaplow, and it looks like it's getting pretty close for him. We don't know. It could be today. It could be 2 weeks, but we know it's close." And he wanted to call some people. So Lawson and I talked with him, were able to thank him, and so on. And mostly he breathed on the other end of the line. And then we got off. And we called many of the people at our group, knew him, and some quite closely, and we called people together, and we told them in sesshin, so they would know. And besides, there's nothing like someone's demise or our own impending demise to spark up one's practice. So they're emotional, but we didn't hear anything more. And now it's evening. And what we have done, sometimes he and I do Doksan at the same time in different places, but at that time we were alternating. So Lawson had gone down first to get Doksan. It's around 7:20. And I'm facing out because we were also using the stick in our small group. And I'm looking out, and there are altars on that side. And I'm looking at the guy next to the altar who's just doing this the whole time. You know, you've seen it. Maybe you've done it. He was just kept doing, nodding up. And here it is, you know, Roshi's, possibly his death day. Turned out, of course, it was. It turned out he'd already died, but we didn't know it. And this guy is just like checked out. And I, by gum, I was going to give a talk. So I stood up before using the stick ready to give a talk. It came up, and I've learned, comes up, you give it. And I couldn't. It was the weirdest thing. I'd never experienced this, actually before or since. It was like duct tape across my mouth. I thought, weird, but I'll use the stick, and then I'll give a talk. So I use the stick and put it down, and now I'm going to give this talk. And again, it's like I couldn't move my mouth. I couldn't give any talk. It felt very strange. So then I sat down, and suddenly, Roshi was right here. And he was flying. He was so free. All those, 15 or more years of Parkinson's getting more and more, held in. Suddenly, he was so present. And just this joy. And it was as though there was this gauze screen, this very delicate gauze. I hadn't seen it. And he just went, check this out. And I looked. And this guy nodding over here, everything was perfect. Everything was so whole and perfect, just as it was. Everything was just shining. Just tears, and it was like his last teaching. And I had the feeling that he was just seeing it so clearly too, and just had to share it. And then after the sitting, we checked the phones, and he had died out here in the back. Some of you were fortunate to be present at that time. And afterward, the Sesshin was over, and there was the funeral service going to happen here. I was determined to get to this funeral service. It meant jumping in a car after a 7-day Sesshin and just driving all the way. And there were others who were willing to do that. A storm was brewing, was blowing up. I could see the mountains, lightning coming and all this. But I really felt we gotta go. And suddenly, this rainbow happened in the sky. I mean, a rainbow like I've never seen there. It was like a triple rainbow. It was so vivid. And I went, okay. And it just, somehow it was so clear. We didn't need to go. It's right here. We didn't need to go. I would have loved to have been there, don't get me wrong. But I also saw that everybody was exhausted. I would have been putting people in danger. And it turned out quite a storm that came right up, went up north, and it would have been a rough trip at best. So, okay, just, that's it. And that night, we sat and looked out over the mountains, this wonderful view of these mountains, and it was like a light show. I'd never seen one like that. It was just amazing. This incredible light show over the mountains. And just felt, this is what we have to do. We have to stay right here. And that brings me to the memorial service. I don't know, did I ever... I think I could have talked about it here. The memorial service, we're, a number of us were asked to give a talk out at Chapin Mill. And I couldn't figure out what I wanted to say ahead of time. So I figured it'll come. And we had to step up on a platform like this. And each person took off their shoes over here and then stepped up on the platform. People said later, I thought you guys were like praying before you got up. Couldn't see our feet. Couldn't see what we were doing, right? So we just, each person just putting the head down and then getting up. But getting up on that platform was one of my peak experiences of my life. It was just amazing to get up there and look out at this sea of faces. People from all different decades of the history here. People who come in from far away for this. And I gave some talk that's written somewhere, I guess. But in that moment of standing there, looking out, I'm so grateful that I had enough good sense to just stop for those seconds and just take it in. It was like some giant Easter egg basket, you know, all these different colored Easter eggs and all these wonderful people practiced with over time, and or maybe didn't know at all, but just all these faces all gathered there for this memorial service, and it was just wondrous. And it's wondrous to be here today, back in the Zendo where I feel like I grew up, you know, and which I guess is quite literal. And just to be able to share some of these things with you, and so appreciate people keeping this Dharma practice alive in all different situations that we are in, all different kinds of living and work situations, keeping this alive here and down where we are, all over the country, all over the globe. There's people in Mexico and people in Poland and Germany and everywhere working on this. When has it ever been more vital? When has it ever been more essential that we cut through this ancient delusion and keep working, you know, for the sake of all beings? That one of my favorite quotes is the one I read in an Andrew Harvey book, probably the one on Rumi, I'm not sure, where Andrew Harvey turns to the Dalai Lama, and you probably already heard this, but just in case, he turns to the Dalai Lama and says, if the world is going up in flames as the predictions go, why would we keep vowing to be reborn here again and again, you know, to save all beings? And the Dalai Lama's best thing I ever heard from him, I mean, he said some great things, don't get me wrong, but this is my favorite, where he said, if the world is going to go up in flames, then it's never been more important to be a bodhisattva, because only a bodhisattva will carry water to those on fire. Mm-hmm. So really to bring forth this bodhi mind is what a wonderful task in this life. I've never found anything that compared to it, you know. And there's this term, Sanskrit term came upon, it's not even a Buddhist term as far as I know. It's called Sada Shiva, one word. And it means the force working within us for liberation. The force working within every one of us for liberation. It gets so messed up, it gets so distorted, it gets so corrupted and obscured. But with this practice, with this real sincere practice, this comes forth. If we don't bring it forth consciously, it'll work itself out through all kinds of other ways. I think I heard this term from Nisargadatta, Sri Nisargadatta. As he put it, it doesn't necessarily adhere to ahimsa, to vow of nonviolence. And when we turn our backs on this, it finds ways, often not comfortable ways, to bring us back around, or like the border collie nipping at the heels, you know, the cows or the sheep, and get them into the barn. Our life will do that. But what a great opportunity we have to uphold this practice, you know, to keep deepening it together and for the sake of all beings. So I'm going to finish here. That seems to be the end of this. And we have time, right?
Yes,
all right. Great. We have time for people. Is this the reason, really, to have people facing in this other way, that it's a little more conducive to you guys say also saying something, and you don't, it can be questions, or it can be anything that this brings up for you. You don't have to be constrained to some theme, but I would invite you now to do that. I only have one question. Do you turn this off for people's, for this part?
No, we leave it run, and then if we have our choice, we can, you know, can
okay.
keep it, or we can
okay.
keep it.
Yeah.
The streaming, though.
After the streaming.
You usually turn it off for questions and answers, but everybody has their own way. So I just don't want to constrain people. That's all. Remembering how I used to feel. Okay. So, thank you, and please speak up if anything is live for you here. Dwayne, I could count on you. Go ahead.
I wanted to hear how Windhorse is doing.
Oh, well. but you know, maybe I can say more about that afterward.
Yes.
Okay. But we're doing fine. We're a small group. And with a beautiful place and plenty of work to do. So thanks for asking, and maybe we can catch up after, if anybody's interested, but I just soon now keep it more to here. Yes.
So just a short question. I was just kind of wondering when you kind of first felt that you need to become a teacher. How did that really come? And
oh, interesting. I never felt I needed to become a teacher. Actually, truly, I did used to come. Talks used to well up in me in Sesshin. I even remember going to Bodhin Roshi now and saying, "You could talk about this," badgering him a little, because I needed some outlet, and poor guy, you know, he's not going to take a talk that I'd come up with, but no, you could talk about this, these images. It was my worst makyo, really, was that these talks that would come up, but I didn't have that in mind. I was busy with kids, you know, and all of that stuff, and I strangely never felt ambitious about it, and it wasn't necessarily virtue. I just never, it wasn't there for me. And so when Roshi, I got the call before he was going to leave in November of, I don't know, 94 or something. Someone called me up on the phone and said, "Well, Roshi wants to sanction you tomorrow morning in the library at 10:30 or whatever it was. Will you be there?" Okay.
Kind of distinguish between Roshi.
I'm sorry, Roshi
please,
Kaplow.
Please call me Bodhin.
Oh, I'll call you both Roshi. Yeah.
No, Bodhin.
My role, okay. Roshi Kaplow was sanctioned me in a small private ceremony. Then we had a bigger one a year later when I was also ordained. But it was kind of sudden, and so I didn't have many thoughts about that, I guess, and it happened.
Sanya.
Yes.
You do convey a lot of enthusiasm for the life of Zen.
Good. I'm glad to hear, you know, what Blake said. Enthusiasm is the all in all. But I'm glad to hear it, because I have a lot. Yeah. I've sometimes said to people, if you know anything better, if you know anything that's, you know, goes deeper, quicker, better, I want to hear about it. Because then I'll, you know, maybe if I find it, that's... But this has been amazing lifetime, you know? Really... Amazing lifetime. What a thing.
Roshi, my first session was with you here in the 4-day, and I just remember just wanting to get out of there, you know, after the first couple of days. But I mean, you really motivated me in your enthusiasm to stick it out. And also, I was, you know, 20-something and sitting between two women who were older than my mom, and I just remember thinking, like, I can't give up if they can
right.
do it. So proud and macho. But you inspired me to keep going, and that was my first step into this.
Oh, cool. Thank you. That's great to hear. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people have it. It's kind of a macho that happens and the first day or two. Gotta get the hell out of here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I had it all planned out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and sometimes they do. That's tough, you know, cause it's hard to get back. But, it's kind of a macho that occurs. It's not uncommon. Oh, I remember that. Was that the Ryokan where I did the Ryokan?
Oh, I have no idea.
I remember because it was somebody fainted right there my first time. I'm giving 4-day sesshin. And I'm, you know, the ton was up here close, and all kinds of hell's breaking loose over here. And some guy had fainted, and the monitors were taking him out, and it was wild and crazy. And it was super hot, August.
No,
wasn't August.
It was December. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I also remember I had taken myself so seriously, but in early days. But I remember. Before this 4-day, I think it was the Ryokan, I think it was the August one, I'd gone to the bathroom during Kinhin, and I'd re-entered the line, and I was standing in front of the teacher's spot over there, and we ended Kinhin. I was going to go give Taisho, and I reached back and I realized that my robe had got hiked up. Well, it must have been December because I was wearing long underwear. Thank goodness. My robe had got hiked, you know, how it caught in my belt. And I've been walking around in Kinhin with this robe up. So fortunately, I had long underwear on at least. But I remember I just laughed. It was the funniest thing in earlier days before Zen practice. That would have devastated me. So it was, yeah, lots of things have happened over time. They're wonderful. I'm sure you're aware of that line by Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton, where he said, angels can fly because they take themselves lightly. You know, oh, what a relief to...
The history of the center is so rich. And I was just wondering, actually, when you were talking about Roshi Phil Kaplow passing away, Tony Packer passing away, that came to mind. What do you remember about that time, and is there anything you take away from it, the transition? And
oh, that time, 89, 90, right? Whoa, that was quite a time. Oh, I could talk about that for a while. I don't think you want that. But... you know, at that time, okay, I'll give you my two bits. And the hierarchy here had really reached its nth degree. The Japanese hierarchical, patriarchal system was very strong. And And at that time, it had really reached its high point, if you can call it that. And so Tony really questioned a lot of things that ultimately I think needed to be questioned. It's just that the split with the Sangha was so terribly painful, all that was done. But, I have a lot of things I could say about that. And I remember the meeting, I was at the meeting in the Buddha Hall, as many of us were, when that came up and she spoke and Roshi Kapila spoke. I think it was awfully hard for her here because she was surrounded by a staff that she'd never been on staff. She didn't know the protocol. She didn't know the ways things were done. And she met with a lot of resistance, I think. That must have been tough. I know, I'm sure that Bodhin Roshi would have things to say about that. He was probably here, although he wasn't, I don't recall him being any part of that resistance. There was other things going on. I was busy with kids, so I was glad to be out of the politics of that altogether. But it was this very samurai. There was strong samurai. The guys here at the center used to go, and John, probably you remember this better than I, and it used to go to U of R, every samurai movie, and they seemed to play them a lot. The Seven Samurai and Sanjuro and Yosh, Jimbo or whatever it is. And they go, and they would walk around like samurai, you know? I remember, because we didn't used to have a dress code. There were no robes when I started sitting. Oh, we were a motley crew. The must have driven Roshi Kapila crazy. I remember I went out to Salvation Army and I found a navy blue, fittingly, jumper that was too big for me. I was losing weight like crazy when I first came here. And I must have looked like a Salvation Army person, you know, with the rings a bell. My first sashin, I sat over there. Oh, look who's there. Hi. I sat over there, and I was to my right was a woman in a pink pantsuit, a pink print pantsuit, with little like bears or something all over it. And so I'm walking behind her for days. And the Makyo is pink pantsuit. You know, people say, oh, why do we need a dress code? I'll tell you why we need a dress code. And then, sitting over here, and to my right was a young woman, friend, who had made herself a skirt, and she'd made a skirt out of fake fur. So she's sitting there with a skirt made of fake fur, and I the whole time I kept feeling like I was next to a little animal. An animal over here. And it was so funny. But so then the first robes came in from Japan. Roshi Kapila must have thought, damn it, we're gonna get these people looking like something. So he ordered these robes from Japan. Now they were blue and white robes, with this pattern, you've probably seen it. They're called yukatas. And so it was just for the guys, only the guys, and they would put on these yukatas, and they started wearing, I think, the obis. Yeah, you had to, because that's the only way to hold it together. And I remember walking behind a big guy, who shall be unnamed, and who, it just, that swagger. Oh, this was swagger. Yeah. And the women were, oh, please. And, but then, when we found out, when we discovered that these were actually Japanese men's bathrobes. it was hilarious to us, you know. So they were set aside, and the first robes were, I remember because I had one of the first robes, deep, beautiful green. Deep green. I don't remember why we switched that over.
Nilda let us know. They were on sale. Brown fabric was on sale.
Oh, the brown fabric was on sale, and so we have this. almost 50 years later. So, the brown fabric was on sale, so everything's brown. Plus, we should remember that in making all these color decisions, which of course have quite an effect for decades to come, Roshi Kapila was colorblind. He could not see a cardinal, a red cardinal, in a green tree. Mm. He was colorblind. So there you have it. but anyway, yeah. Your question brings up many, many possible responses. We have a couple more minutes.
Sure. Hey, Sonia.
Yes.
I wasn't actually around when major samurai action was happening.
Oh.
But I heard a great story the first time they showed a series at the drive-in.
Oh, yeah.
Roshi Kapila went along with all, you know, the young guys. And the next day, somebody described, they're sitting here, maybe in the monitor seat, and one by one, these guys come in, and it's just like, you know, Yojimbo coming down the aisle. And then finally, Roshi Kapila comes in and just... I just thought that was great.
Yeah, oh yeah.
The other maddening thing to me, because I was, you know, like going, I don't like this so much, you know, was the beret fashion. Roshi Kapila wore a beret.
Right. So therefore.
I think people would say that you could rock that beret.
Yeah.
But everybody else decided they would wear one.
Of course. All the guys. All the guys.
All the guys. And I remember walking down the street one time, and there was somebody I knew quite well from the center doing a Zen walk with his Zen beret on, and I just thought, no.
So you were swept up in that. Yeah, people talked like Roshi Kapila, they walked, you know, everything. Yeah, it was quite a time. And people used to walk out here with their eyes down, you know. You go out into the street and just walk into town, eyes glued. I remember coming back, we used to have a staff house there, Meg Street, coming from there, and there was this glorious rainbow over the center. And there was this guy walking along, eyes glued. You know, it just was all... Yeah, we have to be careful. We need to... And keeping eyes up is an interesting thing because a lot of heads go down. And you say eyes down, heads go down and cause all kinds of damage. We need to see what's going on. And in the Zendo, of course, then we have the luxury to keep our eyes down. Anyway, that's a particular thing of mine that's come up in doing Tai Chi.
I have a question.
Yes.
Hi. Sometimes we hear from people in spiritual practice that their children, you know, they express the feeling that children are an obstacle to their practice. I'd just like, I'd be interested to know how you feel maybe your children enriched and deepened your own personal journey.
Oh, I don't think I could stand myself if I hadn't had a bunch of children to wear me down. I mean, really, it's great ego attrition, very humbling. And for me, it was a doorway into the world of play and wonder and joy that I don't know that I would have been able to really go there. I didn't relate much to children until I had them. And then it just like opened up. And I'm so grateful for that. I wasn't always so grateful. I remember going to Roshi Kapila. I want to go to Zazen. I can't go to Zazen. And him saying, Sonia, he said, your time will come. And it was really important to me that he said that. And I thought, okay. But I felt pretty impatient at times. I have to say that. I wanted to get on with this practice, get back to more Sushins. I went to Sushin too early when my first two kids were young. In those days, this is a great danger, in those days, it was like the best thing you can do for all the world, including your little baby children, is to go to Sushin. No wrong. You have little ones, you stay with them. You don't just, you know, leave them with somebody. And I did. I went. So I waited for the 3.5 years with the third one, and 4 years for the fourth, and just really was there for them. But we can't, you know, it's really important not to leave them too young. But I'm eternally grateful for karma that it, despite myself, I wasn't going to have children. I wasn't going to get married. I wasn't going to have children. I got married twice here at Roshi Kaplow and had four of them. So you never know what life.
We're talking about our compact.
Oh, our comp. You want me to tell them about our compact? We had an agreement that if either one of us was ever deluded enough to consider getting married, we would stop the other one. Well, he didn't hold up his end. So I didn't hold up either. Yes, Jen. Yes, I was hoping you weren't with having another comment because I saw it was time. All right. It is time. And so thank you all for being here. It was wonderful to be here again. And now I'm going to turn around and we're going to recite the four vows and you're just going to leave that on in time. Okay. All beings without number,
I bow to the great endless wine passion. I bow to all fruit, dark brigades beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to the great endless life passions. I bow to all truth, Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to the great endless flying passions. I bow to uproot dark gates beyond measure. I bow.